Hey, listeners, before we kick off today's episode of the Gita Hold of Yourself official podcast, we want to take a moment to plug two very important programs happening virtually in honor of Black History Month. Gita's annual Bridge Speaker event is an open invitation to learn about the BIPOC Safe for Spaces resolution and what it means to be anti-racist from our community partners on campus and our Bridge keynote speaker, Black feminist queer cultural memory worker, curator, and organizer Kara Page. We're super excited. Additionally, CMEI's Critical Discussions on Race is a conversation on race and racism. This year, CDR will focus on how institutions of higher learning can move forward in anti-racist work and the role that students have in this movement. There is a lot going on here and many, many ways to engage. We hope to see you at some of these events next week. They're taking place February 24th through 26th. And you can visit the CMEI website at www.msudenver.edu/CMEI/campus events for all information regarding Black History Month programming. Once again, thank you for tuning in.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Gita Hold of Yourself podcast put on by the Gender Institute for Teaching and Advocacy. As always, we are a podcast that discusses topics through a lens of intersectionality. And joining me today are Lauren Gutierrez and Nettie Rodriguez, and we're going to be talking about the Safer Spaces Resolution. Or you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, Lauren, and then I'll introduce myself and Nettie.
Yeah, I can introduce myself. My name is Lauren. I have a few different roles on campus. So I'm a student. I have a major in psychology and a minor in social work. I'm also the vice president of PsyChi, which is the International Honor Society for psychology students. I'm the secretary for Building Allies of Diversity, the student social work organization. I'm also a peer mentor. And I am one of the MSU Denver representatives for the Auraria Campus Police Department Community Advisory Board.
That's a mouthful. You have a lot of really cool hats that you're wearing around campus. So I guess I'll introduce myself. I'm Nastasia Santana. I didn't say it in the intro, but that's okay. I do not wear as many hats as Lauren, but I am a student staff member at GITA. I handle stuff with the team on the academics and outreach branch. And I am president, I guess. I don't really like that title, but technically president of Triota, an honor society housed within GITA. And I also co-wrote the BIPOC resolution. And I'm just gonna pass the mic to Nettie to introduce themselves.
Thanks, Nastasia. Thank you so much for having us on this podcast episode. Super exciting to hear kind of all the different hats that both of you wear. And my name's Nettie Rodriguez Arauz. My pronouns are they, them, theirs, and I'm associate director for GITA. And I'm also one of the co-authors of the BIPOC Safer Spaces Resolution. And super excited to be here to chat all things resolution.
Yeah. Well, how about we just jump right into it? I feel like the BIPOC resolution is something that's been making the rounds lately, and it's been ruffling some feathers and getting things moving, and people have been talking about it in various spheres. And I guess we can start with you, Lauren, since Nettie and I, you kind of know how we got involved with the resolution in terms of writing it, but how did you come into getting involved with the resolution and your thoughts about it?
Yeah, so I originally got involved with the resolution through Building Allies of Diversity. we kind of set our intentions at the beginning of the year of what we wanted to do as a club. And a lot of that had to do with kind of building anti-racism community on campus. And yeah, so I really support the resolution. And that's kind of why I got involved.
I'd love to hear more about BAD, Lauren. If you want to share more about, like, what do you all do?
Yeah, definitely. So we basically strive to create a safe environment to have hard conversations about social justice, inclusivity, and diversity among the MSU Denver community. We are a group of people that are interested in social work. Many of our members are social work majors. And we have a few folks from the MSW program as well.
That's awesome. Really cool. So I guess I'd like to take this moment then where you're talking about the BIPOC resolution, and it may be worthwhile to sort of give some context in terms of how it came about. And Nettie, feel free to jump in if I'm leaving any holes in the story, but sort of where I came to hear about the BIPOC resolution, or at least the first sort of rumblings of there being some kind of a thing that we need to do, was in response to the more high profile murders of Black lives that happened at the hands of police brutality. And so, you know, for me, thinking about these kinds of things really started with Ahmaud Arbery, and pretty much cascaded from there. Every subsequent murder, just constantly all the time on the news, hearing people getting abused and pelted with rubber bullets and things like that when they were going out to do like the protests and the BLM protests. And I remember that in Gita, there was actually a lot of rumbling about, like, what are we going to do? Like, how are we going to respond? We had put out responses, like written responses to the community, just to stand in solidarity with BLM, to admonish the police. And, you know, this was all great, but at the end of the day, it didn't necessarily, I feel it didn't solve or satiate the hunger for systemic change in the areas that we could affect and impact. So I know it was our chair, Kat Martinez, who sort of put out the call and just said, like, we got to do something. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I have a little bit of a draft together. Let's get together and talk about it. And so some folks from GITA, including Nettie, some folks from Chicano-Chicanx Studies, and some folks from Africana Studies, you know, they all got together, including the chairs of all three departments. We all got together and sort of drafted this resolution. I remember Kat, Nettie, and I stayed pretty damn late to really nail down, like, what is it that the students and the faculty of color need to feel safe on this campus. And so we were all bringing in our thoughts and ideas from working with the community here on campus and working with the students and faculty. And so that's how the BIPOC resolution sort of came about. It was a response to police brutality and anti-Blackness, and came around to this sort of framework for, or not even a framework, more like an action plan of how we can better serve our Black and Brown students. Anything you'd like to add, Nettie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a really great synopsis. Thank you for sharing all that. And I think, Lauren, probably providing some context for you, because I know that BAD kind of came in a little bit later in the planning process, and awesome to have BAD and other allies a part of our, what I see is kind of a growing collaborative around around this issue. So it's super exciting. I will also say that there were other folks who were around the table as well. So Megan Lazorski, who I believe is out of the chemistry department for MSU Denver, was there during some of those original conversations. And kind of in the spirit of the sanctuary resolution, which is a resolution that GITA also drafted in collaboration with other departments several years ago during the DACA walkouts. I want to say in 2017, 2016, we kind of continued that work kind of in the spirit of that resolution. And so I think it's important to kind of note that even though our institutions have made pretty big declarations, kind of what that looks and feels like in the day-to-day, I think it can be very confusing. So I was excited to be a part of that authoring process, especially when it came to some of the action points, which I believe you wrote a lot of, right, Nastasia?
Yeah, it was really, I feel, a collaborative effort. I was sort of like trying to bring together all the ideas of everything that was said in the initial meetings. And like, I feel like everybody had a really good idea of what they needed to be supported. And then also our dear Ikaika Gleisberg, who has since moved on to other prospects, they were also at this meeting and just throwing out these really awesome ideas in terms of thinking about the abolition prospect of it and the divesting from Wells Fargo and the halting of like the business relationships that we have with prisons for prison labor. The majority of our furniture is given to us through prison labor. And so sort of cutting ties with some of these structures of this policing system and this prison industrial complex that really just harm our students and it doesn't serve us in any way. So yeah, there were just so many contributions from everybody who was at these meetings. And so I really just wanted to be able to get everybody's voice in there. And I think that, you know, in subsequent drafts and revisions and things like that, it really worked out that way.
I think so too. And I'm super proud of the Safer Spaces resolution. And, you know, even though it has become kind of a bit of a controversial topic, I think that we're achieving our goal of engaging people in discourse and, you know, challenging people to sit in their own discomfort around what it means to be an anti-racist or do anti-racist work. And, you know, it's interesting. I was just now, as you were sharing, Nastasia, looking at our resolution again, because I was like, God, it's so cool. I want to bring it up, you know, like it's just to have it here while we're chatting. And I see that the actionable pieces are, it's really like a long list, right, of things that we can do as an institution. And it's compartmentalized in, you know, different buckets, right? So academics and other things. And yet we continue to kind of, as an institution, really struggle with particular points in the resolution that you mentioned, Nastasia. I'm like curious about hearing from you and hearing from Lauren too. And like, what's up with that?
There was a lot of support, I feel, starting out, like when we came out with this resolution. But there were several departmental as well as individual issues around the resolution. I feel the biggest one had to do with policing, but there were also other critiques in thinking about the wording. For instance, why do we use BIPOC instead of listing out every nationality and race and ethnicity of color, including, you know, and so we've had to sort of gather our thoughts and our intentions around some of these things. So it is a really complicated conversation, right? Because when you say Black, Indigenous, people of color, it is intended that API and Latina, Latinx are also included in the POC portion of it. And so it's really a question of why are we centering Black and Indigenous folks? Why are we signaling them specifically? And for that, I can only talk about our intentions, which is that, you know, we're talking about the displacement and the police brutality that is currently being inflicted on Indigenous folks and Black folks that we are seeing right now happen in our living history. And that isn't to say that people who don't identify as Black or Indigenous are not also facing systemic harm as a result of institutionalized racism. But it is to say that the colorism, the colonization, it has been extremely genocidal on Black and Indigenous communities. That's really the goal of the colonization that we see here in the United States. And so I think that that's part of what we are addressing with the BIPOC resolution, while also recognizing that, you know, people of color who identify in a various number of ways are also impacted by colonization.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the transition from POC to BIPOC, I think, is really critical and really intentional. In that transition, there are folks who feel some kind of way about that, about what it means to center Black and Indigenous folks, right? Or Brown Latinx folks.
Right.
And yeah, I think oftentimes we forget that there's actually like an and in there, right? Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And so it is inclusive, and anti-racism work needs to be inclusive of all folks, right? All folks who are marginalized by the system. And yeah, I agree with you. We're not discounting the lived experiences of folks who are not Black or Indigenous, but we are centering the very real and violent experience, right, that they face at the hands of colonization, capitalism, police brutality, et cetera. And speaking of, you know, police brutality, this is where I think, Lauren, you know, if you wanted to chime in and chat about your work with the Auraria Advisory Board, and in particular, like where BAD stands on anti-policing, and because that is the sticky piece, right? Like, I just looked at that resolution again, and there's like literally 30 different action points, and yet we cannot wrap our brains around this concept of defunding the police.
And I just like to point out that how, or what it means, right, to see that there's so many action points, and, you know, most of the people who do have issues with the stance on policing also agree with all of the other action points. So it really goes to show, like, sort of the how concretized the structure of policing and, like, the institution of policing is, to the point where we're willing to sacrifice a load of good stuff for the policing.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think it's a difficult conversation to have with the community, right? Because we're talking about safety. And a lot of people tie safety to police officers, but that's not really the case for the entire community. And what I think the resolution is really trying to do is make space for the people that aren't made safe by police officers. Also, BAD definitely, I don't know how to say this, I guess we look at it as like rehabilitation versus being like punitive with community policing. I think the argument against getting rid of police is like kind of a scare tactic, right?
What is that common argument for our listeners?
I guess it's probably known as like the thin blue line, right? That whole argument where police officers kind of hold together a whole society, and without police officers, there would be no moral judgment or, I guess, general safety in the streets.
It'd be anarchy.
Yes.
Yeah, some of the things I hear are like, what if there's sexual assault? What if there's, you know, what if there's interpersonal violence, things like that? And, you know, who are you going to call if there's no police? And I always think, well, first of all, even when we call the police on those things, it never ends well. There's rarely justice for the people who need it, people who are assaulted and who are typically, like, when we think about the people who are assaulted, they're generally people who are already disenfranchised in our communities. And so to say that, well, what'll happen if the police aren't here to answer that call? Well, I imagine that there wouldn't be a ton of change. And I think that that's at the crux of the defund the police movement and thinking about like demilitarizing the police, in that we do believe that the police hold up our society, and therefore we're willing to throw buckets and buckets of money at them. And so we neglect and underfund the programs or the potential for programs that could better handle situations of domestic violence or, you know, mental health crises, things like that, which I believe that BAD is really doing some good work in theorizing what that would look like without involving the police.
Yeah, so we're definitely trying to with our panel in this conference that is coming up, the Building Coalitions for Care and Liberation Conference. But yeah, so basically we just want to explore what that could look like for our campus, because it is possible, you know, other people are doing it in Denver even. It's not as scary as it sounds.
It really isn't. And I loved the bit that you mentioned earlier about kind of wanting to move away from punitive measures, right? And thinking about rehabilitation in our communities. And when you were saying that, I immediately started thinking about the transformative justice movement and the conversations that communities are having around what community accountability can look like without involvement from the state. And there are collectives all over the country, including in Denver, who are working toward building communities where harm can be addressed, accountability can happen. And we know that that harm happens like within our own communities. It happens from the state. It happens from people who are in dominant identities, who have power over others in our country. But it really isn't that far-fetched of an idea. The idea that we would, or that we could, reinvest all of the funds, right, that we spend on policing every year into community resources and community support, community-based programs that essentially equip people with the skills to be able to do community work, accountability work, you know, without the involvement of the violent police state. And so, yeah, I really love that you brought that up about rehabilitation. And you also mentioned this conference that's coming up, which is our 31st annual Bridge Speaker event and serves as a bridge between Black History Month in February and Women's History Month in March. We're super excited to be doing a two-day program this year in a virtual setting. And yeah, can you share a little bit more about the panel that you're going to be doing later this month?
Yeah, so BAD is organizing a panel for this Building Coalitions for Care and Liberation Bridge 2021 event. And it's called Beyond Anti-Racism Education, exploring the role of helping professionals. So it's going to be a 90-minute moderated panel with Councilwoman Candice Itabaka. We're going to have Regan Bird and Dr. Travis Heath all there. They're so amazing.
Yes, awesome.
Councilwoman Itabaka is the current representative for District 9. Regan Bird is an anti-oppression specialist. So Regan Bird is an award-winning anti-oppression activist, speaker, and trainer who has trained dozens of organizations in anti-oppression and allyship, including the Colorado Midwives Association, the Sierra Club, and the Colorado Democratic Party, among a lot of others. Yeah, and basically she's been really recognized in our Denver community for her anti-oppression training. And then, Dr. Travis Heath is actually an MSU Denver professor as well. He's currently on a one-year leave, though, to serve as a visiting clinical associate professor at the University of Denver, where he's directing the Trauma, Disaster, and Recovery Clinic, as well as serving as the director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for the Graduate School of Professional Psychology. And he will become an associate professor at the University of Denver and assume co-directorship of the International Disaster Psychology, Trauma, and Global Mental Health Graduate Program. So with these folks, we're going to be having a conversation about basically the role of helping professionals in anti-racism community building. We also wanted to have a focus on, like, what can students do now? How can they start building these communities? What can community members start doing? We just really wanted this to be a starting point. So I think anti-racism education is so important. It's an aspect that you should have always and continually. But we wanted to bring this other piece together of, like, actually putting that in action.
Yeah, I think that is going to be a really important piece to bring into the conversation when we're talking about anti-racism. Recently, I had the great fortune of going to Creating Changes, the conference. And I attended a workshop with abolitionist leader and national director for Black and Pink, Dominique Morgan. And one of the things that I was really able to take away from that experience was how hungry people were for things that they can do, actually take into their hands and do and add to the, I guess, the discourse and the general just atmosphere of, like, what is already happening in the wake of these murders and in the wake of, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests. And one of the things that I've noticed within that is sort of like this feeling of helplessness in that, okay, yes, I myself am working on anti-racism work, but I navigate whole communities that if there are members who are working in this way, I don't see them. How do I call out to them? How do I call out to my community members who aren't doing anti-racism work and have them see that this is worthwhile work to be doing for everybody? So I think that having a panel where we can talk about, like, what students can actually do, those concrete steps of here's how we build coalitions and here's how we amplify voices, I think that'll be a really good conversation to have.
I agree. And in some ways, it's kind of the focal point of a lot of programming that's happening this month, right? We know it's Black History Month, and there's always been programming on our campus around Black History Month, but this month in particular, I think, is unique in that we have all endured, right, the last 4 years. And as we've been talking, last year kind of was a game changer for Black Lives Matter, for the conversation around anti-racism, for the conversation on what we can do And so yeah, the panel that Lauren you're hosting is one of several panels that will be happening during our Bridge Speaker event, all kind of surrounded around the idea of like how to engage in this work, how to build coalition, how to build community, how to do self-advocacy, right? TRIO, CAMP, and ISP are going to be hosting a panel on self-advocacy. The Brother to Brother program for CMEI is hosting critical discussions on race that same week. The Black World Conference is kicking off next week on, you know, the impacts of COVID, right, on the Black community. So there is a lot of opportunity here to kind of really engage in discourse and dialogue about some of these sticky points. And I don't know about y'all, but I feel like if MSU Denver is going to make the commitment to being an anti-racist institution, we have to do the work. Like really, really do the work. And absolutely. I think that anti-racism is a word that has become such a buzzword that I think in some ways people have lost sight of what it actually means to be anti-racist and to do anti-racist work. And so I really look forward to the different programs and panels that are going to be happening that week and hope that it kind of, you know, empowers people to think about like what it actually means to be anti-racist. And is it even possible? Like, is it even possible to do that within the confines of MSU Denver and an academic institution? I don't actually know. There's this part of me that feels like as an institution, we have signed ourselves up for a commitment that might be beyond our means, or, you know, like that might not be feasible. I'm curious to hear what you all think. Also, please argue with me. Maybe I need to have a little bit more faith in our institution, but some of us are tired and have been doing this work for a very long time. And so, yeah, there's this part of me that feels like if this resolution is having such a hard time, like reaching people, then maybe we have a bigger issue than we thought we did.
Right. I agree with your points, and I honestly think about this a lot, and I have a lot of conflict, right? Because I find it difficult to know when to take off my staff hat and put on my student hat. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, as a student staff, I have to see things from both sides. And so on one hand, I do understand that this kind of change takes time. If we think about the fact that in the past, 50, 60 years that we've been talking about, like that we talked about civil rights and we basically got scraps, it makes sense in a way that the institutional side of anti-racism work is so slow going because very little has changed in the last 60 years. However, at the same time, from a student's perspective, I see the departments that I gravitate towards, and I see the faculty and the folks who are actually doing this work and being really earnest about doing it. You know, and even people like Dr. Benitez, who does this work, but also has to think about, you know, his positionality within senior admin. So, like, I see these people and I think, well, if we just gave them the mic, I feel like my faith is placed on the people who are tired, right? And who are doing this work and who are exhausted yelling at, you know, senior admin, board of trustees, doing all these trainings, doing all of these things to try and hold the university accountable for its declaration that they're going to be an anti-racist institution. And like you said, it's something that really we haven't even fully grasped equity yet. How are we going to just propel right into anti-racism? And so that's where, as a student, I'm just like, I really have a lot of faith in the departments and the faculty who are doing this work. But even as faculty and chairs, we are still so far removed from the seats of, you know, folks like Dr. Davidson, folks like the Board of Trustees. Our voices are still so far removed. And so we're having to scream extra loud. And as students, faculty, and you know, admin from these departments, it's taxing. It totally makes sense that you're feeling tired and a little jaded.
Yeah, I agree. I think it totally makes sense because, like, that's the way our society is set up, right? We're here, we're having to scream about this kind of work, you know, be really loud about it. And a large response that we're getting is like that it's not okay for us to even have our voice on campus. At least that's how I feel in a lot of these kind of conversations and spaces. But I do think it is possible. I think we just have to, you know, keep at it. And I also think that's part of the reason why we build community, right? Like, so we can support each other through this.
I love that you mentioned that, the building community piece, because I think that's so true. Nastasia and I always talk about how much we miss the GITA space and being on campus, and how, and I'm sure you do too, right? Because the peer mentors had your own spot. I had been there a couple times. I remember walking in there and being like, oh, this place, it like feels so good, you know? So I think that you can relate to this idea, Lauren, that like, yeah, we often talk about and lament over kind of how much physical space can really bring people together in community. Thank you for sharing, both of you. I think it's always helpful to be reminded that even though some of us are really exhausted, the struggle is worth it and the fight is worth it, and it can happen. The conversation continues to be almost always around, right, the policing issue, and almost always around the defunding of or the divestment from multinational corporations, which is also in the resolution. I mean, how can we truly engage in anti-racist work when we are funding buildings by Lockheed Martin, when we are going into partnership with institutions like Wells Fargo, who funded, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline project in part? So yeah, that those are the pieces that feel really kind of confusing to me. And Lauren, I know that you sit on this community advisory board for the Arare Campus Police. And so I'm curious about, what are the conversations happening there? And is the board aware of the resolution? What are some plans? I'm curious, what's the tea?
Yeah, so I guess I'll start with kind of like the reason why the community advisory board exists. And it was basically to help increase police community relations. I think our campus police department really wants to build a relationship with community members, and they wanted to have a voice from every kind of institution on campus there. So it's like students and staff from each university on campus, and then they also have AHEC representatives. The police chief and the AHEC CEO are also part of these conversations. Right now, we've mainly been talking about body-worn cameras. We're trying to figure out if the campus police should get body-worn cameras. We have yet to kind of like give a vote on that. Right now, we're partnering with a CU Denver psychology course to do a campus survey on how our campus community feels about our police department. I think part of that is going to ask folks if they want body-worn cameras for our campus police. But yeah, we have not specifically talked about the Safer Spaces resolution yet, is that we are actually partnering with SACAB, which is another advisory board for AHEC. And yeah, So I think that's kind of where we're at right now. My personal take on body-worn cameras for police officers is that they're not going to be helpful or increase safety or security for minoritized groups on campus. That's not going to reform a whole police department. I do think our police department is, compared to the Denver Police Department, I think they're amazing. But I also think that policing fundamentally is flawed. And I think we just need to do more. I think it's about that fundamental shift for our campus. Like, instead of just like making plans to reduce harm, like, let's just make a community that doesn't produce that harm in the first place. You know what I mean?
For yeah. sure. And, you know, here's the thing is that a lot of what I hear about, like, in terms of stances on being pro-policing, we talk about a lot about what are essentially intentions, right? Officer Fred so-and-so is a great guy. He just wants to help people. And that's great. However, the institution of policing, the entire practice in and of itself, is born from slavery. Its roots are in slavery. Its roots are in lynching culture. Its roots are having overseers in the fields. And so, you know, there's this quote. Oh, man, I always forget his name. But it goes that police do not protect people. They protect property. And I believe it was actually, well, I heard it from George Lee on Instagram. And that's essentially what it is, right? If we think about slaves as property, this is some of the earliest charges that the police had. And that was what they were intended to guard and to secure. Not ever in the best ways, really. Not ever in any way that's helpful or that offers any kind of dignity or justice to minoritized communities. So absolutely, it has to be gotten rid of. It's one thing to say, you know, bad apples, but what we're looking at is that the whole tree from the roots on up is rotted.
Just to kind of add on to that, it's rotted because the seeds that were originally planted, right, are rooted in white supremacy, mm-hmm. and are rooted in a surrender that, like, fine, if slavery is going to end, fine, then we have to have a system in place that will continue to control and to enslave
and
Black
to
and Indigenous folks and to terrorize, right? And we know that historically, the KKK has its deep, deep roots, you know, in systems of power, including the police force from its origins through today. And so you can't deny that history and that foundation that, you know, the police force as we know it today, you know, has its roots in. That's just a reality. And so how can we then engage in anti-racist work and declare ourselves to be anti-racist while continuing to amplify, fund, lift up, and consider, you know, a system that was created to continue the enslavement of Black and Indigenous people as being necessary? I don't actually know how that's possible. And I think that's the sticky point about anti-racism, is that it is actually, it's a decolonial framework. It is literally calling the entire foundations of this country into question. And it is asking us to consider the ways in which anti-Black racism has been embedded into every facet of this country, like in literally everything. I think it's possible. It's a lot of work, and it's more than just putting up a BLM, you know, post on social media and calling it a day, or taking a microaggressions training that's 2 hours long on campus and calling it a day.
Yeah, I definitely think it's way more than any senior admin or board of trustees have bargained for. But, you know, they already decided that they wanted to jump headlong into the river. So, you know, are you going to try and swim with the current, or are you just going to get swept away?
Yeah.
And at this point, it almost feels like the university is cool with just letting themselves not necessarily lose face, but being okay with saying that they're delivering justice when they aren't, which is unfortunate given that we, like, our university has some of the highest numbers of POC students in Colorado.
I mean, our campus serves students who are the most targeted by all these systems. So if anything, we need to be taking this commitment much more seriously than we are. And I worry that we're not ready for those conversations to happen on this campus, at least among faculty and staff. I think the students are ready.
Yeah.
Would you all agree? I'm not a student. So.
We've been ready for quite some time.
Well, we've been talking about the Safer Spaces resolution in my sci-chi group. And we're actually going to host a kind of event that's just going to talk about the Safer Spaces resolution. Because I think it's raised some concern in our sci-chi group. So, yeah.
I'm glad that you all are having that conversation. I imagine a lot of awesome debate will come out of it.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, we've gotten things back from, like, professors, and we've gotten things back from folks who were like, you know, I identify as a person of color, but I don't necessarily identify as Black or Indigenous, and or I have these other areas, I hold these other privileges, and I do not care for this resolution. And that's the tea. And it's truly upsetting that people who hold areas of marginality in some way, shape, or form in some areas, that they also cannot fathom how other people who are multiply marginalized might be terrified by the police and might, you know, be in much, much worse dire straits. And you know, that these are the people that this BIPOC resolution is for.
Many of whom are students on our campus.
Many of whom, you know, we are absolutely directly involved in their affairs, and we absolutely do owe them to do right by them and to take care of them and to, you know, invest in resources that help these folks to be in a better place. And the idea, it just boggles my mind, the idea that somebody would think that this isn't something that we're supposed to be doing. It's truly the epitome of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I think that we've had a lot of great discussion here, but even in this past 45 minutes to an hour, we haven't scratched the surface. It's such a long and complicated conversation that I would love to continue with you all, as well as, you know, other folks maybe who are in community with Gita and with the resolution, who might also have insights. So that's an open invitation. But I wanted to thank you all for having this conversation with me, at least giving a little bit of some context and how the resolution came about, your pieces in it, the importance that it holds for each of you, and for myself as well. And yeah.
Yeah, I guess I would just like to add that, you know, BAD, Building Allies of Diversity, is a space that folks can go if they want to learn more about this too. Like, please reach out. You can reach out to me specifically. And I just appreciate both of you and the work that you are doing for our campus. It is so, so valuable. Thank you.
Likewise, for sure, to both of you. And I agree. There are many ways to engage. All of our information will be on the podcast description. So if you're interested in learning more about BAD, if you're a student of Auraria, and you want to learn more about the resolution or get involved in, you know, the work that we're doing around the resolution, definitely hit us up and let us know. And in the meantime, come to all of our programming happening at the very end of February. And please also consider attending Critical Discussions on Race, hosted by CMEI, and the Black Worlds Conference, hosted by Africana Studies. So yeah, thanks so much for this conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I guess with that, we'll just bid you all goodbye. And thank you again, listeners, for tuning in to the Get a Hold of Yourself official podcast.